The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 2, Continued. Cassette 5, Side 2.
The death row prisoners were hitched up, with many of them in the shafts, and others pushing from the sides and from behind. The barrel kept swaying and splashing them. And the crimson-cheeked bitches in their twill suits roared with laughter as they urged the children on with clubs. And on the prisoner transport ship from Vladivostok to Sakhalin in 1949, the bitches used these children at knife point for carnal enjoyment. So even 6 months was sometimes enough, too. And it was then that the 12-year-olds crossed the thresholds of the adult prison cells, were equated with adults as citizens possessing full rights, equated by virtue of the most savage prison terms, equated in their whole unconscious life by bread rations, bowls of gruel, their places on the sleeping shelves. That is when that old term of communist re-education, minors, somehow lost its significance, when the outlines of its meaning faded, became unclear, and Gulag itself gave birth to the ringing and impudent word, kids. And with a proud and bitter intonation, these bitter citizens began to use this term to describe themselves, not yet citizens of the country, but already citizens of the archipelago. So early and so strangely did their adulthood begin, with this step across the prison threshold. And upon the 12- and 14-year-old heads burst a lifestyle that was too much for brave men who were experienced and mature. But the young people, by the laws of their young life, were not about to be flattened by this lifestyle, but instead grew into it and adapted to it, just as new languages and new customs are learned without difficulty in childhood. So the juveniles adopted on the run both the language of the archipelago, which was that of the thieves, and the philosophy of the archipelago. And whose philosophy was that? From this life they took for themselves all its most inhuman essence, all its poisonous rotten juice, and as readily as if it had been this liquid and not milk that they had sucked from their mother's breasts in infancy. They grew into camp life so swiftly, not in weeks even, but in days, as if they were not in the least surprised by it, as if that life were not completely new to them, but a natural continuation of their free life of yesterday. Even out in freedom they hadn't grown up in linens and velvets. It had not been the children of secure and powerful parents who had gone out to clip stalks of grain, filled their pockets with potatoes, been late at the factory gate, or run away from factory apprenticeship training. The kids were the children of workers. Out in freedom they had understood very well that life was built upon injustice. But out there things had not been laid out stark and bare to the last extremity. Some of it was dressed up in decent clothing, some of it softened by a mother's kind word. In the archipelago the kids saw the world as it is seen by quadrupeds. Only might makes right. Only the beast of prey has the right to live. That is how we, too, in our adult years, saw the archipelago, but we were capable of counterposing to it all our experience, our thoughts, our ideals, and everything that we had read to that very day. Children accepted the archipelago with the divine impressionability of childhood, and in a few days children became beasts there, and the worst kind of beasts, with no ethical concepts whatever. Looking into the calm and enormous eyes of a horse, or caressing the flattened ears of a guilty dog, how can you deny that they have ethics? The kid masters the truth. If other teeth are weaker than your own, then tear the piece away from them. It belongs to you. There were two basic methods of maintaining kids in the archipelago. In separate children's colonies, principally the younger kids, not yet 15, and in mixed category camps, most often with invalids and women, the senior kids. Both were equally successful in developing animal viciousness, and neither rescued the kids from being educated in the spirit of the thieves' ideals. Take Yura Yermolov. He reports that when he was only 12 years old, in 1942, he saw a great deal of fraud, thievery and speculation going on around him, and arrived at the following judgment about life. The only people who do not steal and deceive are those who are afraid to. As for me, I don't want to be afraid of anything, which means that I too will steal and deceive and live well. And yet for a time his life somehow developed differently. He became fascinated by the shining examples whose spirit he was taught in school. However, having got a taste of the beloved father, and laureates and ministers tell us that this was beyond their capacities, at the age of 14 he wrote a leaflet, "Down with Stalin, hail Lenin." They caught him on that one, beat him up, gave him 58-10, and imprisoned him with the kids and thieves. And Yura Yermolov quickly mastered the thieves' law. The spirit of his existence spiraled upward steeply, and at the age of 14 he had executed his negation of a negation. He had returned to the concept of thievery as the highest and the best of all existence. And what did he see in the children's colony? There was even more injustice than in freedom. The chiefs and the jailers lived off the state, shielded by the correctional system. Part of the kids' ration went from the kitchen into the bellies of the instructors. The kids were beaten with boots, kept in fear, so that they would be silent and obedient. Here it is necessary to explain that the ration of the youngest juveniles was not the ordinary camp ration. Though it sentenced kids to long years of imprisonment, the government did not cease to be humane. It did not forget that these same children were the future masters of communism. Therefore they added milk and butter and real meat to their rations. So how could the instructors resist the temptation of dipping their ladle into the kids' pot? And how could they compel the kids to keep silent, except by beating them with boots? Perhaps one of these kids who grew up in this way will some day relate to us a story more dismal than Oliver Twist. The simplest reply to the overpowering injustices was to create injustices oneself. This was the easiest conclusion, and it would now become the rule of life of the kids for a long time to come, or even forever. But here is what's interesting. In giving the cruel world battle, the kids didn't battle against one another. They didn't look on each other as enemies. They entered this struggle as a collective, a united group. Was this a budding socialism? The indoctrination of the instructors? Oh, come on, cut the cackle, big mouths. This is a descent into the law of the thieves. After all, the thieves are united. After all, the thieves have their own discipline and their own ringleaders. And the juveniles were the apprentices of the thieves. They were mastering the precepts of their elders. Oh, of course, they were intensely indoctrinated. Their instructors came, with 3 stars, 4 stars on their shoulder boards, and read them lectures on the Great War of the Fatherland, on the immortal feat of our people, on the fascist atrocities, on the sunny Stalinist concern for children, on what a Soviet person should be. But the great teaching on society, built on economics alone, knowing nothing of psychology, is ignorant even of that simple psychological law which says that the repetition of anything 5 and 6 times already arouses disbelief, or even more than that, nausea. The kids were disgusted by whatever had been earlier rammed down their throats by their teachers, and now by instructors who simultaneously stole from the kitchen. And even the patriotic speech of an officer from a military unit, "Boys, you have been entrusted with the task of dismantling parachutes. This is valuable silk, the motherland's property. Try to take care of it," had no success. Rushing for overfulfillment of norms and to get extra dishes of cereal, the kids at Krevoshchekovo cut up all the silk into useless scraps. And out of all the seeds sown among them, they took over only the seeds of hate, of hostility to the 58s, and a feeling of superiority over the enemies of the people. This was something that would come in handy later on in the general camps. For the time being, however, there were no enemies of the people among them. Yura Yermolov was just the same kind of typical kid. He had long since exchanged the stupid political law for the wise thieves' law. No one could avoid being cooked up in that mash. No boy could remain a separate individual. He would be trampled, torn apart, ostracized, if he did not immediately declare himself a thieves' apprentice. and all of them took that inevitable oath. Reader, put your own children in their place. Who was the enemy of the kids in the children's colonies? The jailers and the instructors. The struggle was against them. The kids knew their strength very well. The first element in their strength was unity, and the second, impunity. It was only on the outside that they had been driven into here on the basis of the law for adults, but once in here, in the archipelago, they were under the protection of a sacred taboo. "Milk! Chief! Give us our milk!" they would howl, and beat on the door of the cell and break up their bunks and break all the glass in sight, all of which would have been termed armed rebellion or economic sabotage among adults. They had nothing to fear. Their milk would be brought them right away. Or say they were marching a column of kids under armed guard through a city, and it seems even shameful to guard children so strictly. Far from it. They had worked out a plan, a whistle, and all who wanted to scattered in different directions. And what were the guards to do? Shoot? At whom? At children? And so their prison terms came to an end. In one fell swoop, 150 years ran away from the state. You don't enjoy looking silly? Then don't arrest children. Our future novelist, the one who spent his childhood among the kids, will describe to us a multitude of kids' tricks, how they ran riot in the colonies, how they got back at and played nasty tricks on their instructors. Despite the seeming severity of the terms meted out to them and the camp regimen, the kids developed great insolence out of impunity. Here is one of their boastful stories about themselves, which, knowing the typical pattern of the kids' actions, I fully believe. Some excited and frightened children ran to the nurse of a children's colony and summoned her to help one of their comrades who was seriously ill. Forgetting caution, she quickly accompanied them to their big cell for 40. And as soon as she was inside, the whole anthill went into action. Some of them barricaded the door and kept watch. Dozens of hands tore everything off her, all the clothes she had on, and toppled her over. And then some sat on her hands and on her legs. And then, everyone doing what he could and where, they raped her, kissed her, bit her. It was against orders to shoot them, and no one could rescue her until they themselves let her go, profaned and weeping. In general, of course, interest in the female body begins early among boys, and in the kids' cells it was intensely heated up by colourful stories and boasting. And they never let a chance go by to let off steam. Here is an episode. In broad daylight, in full view of everyone, four kids were sitting in the compound of Krivoshchekovo Camp No. 1, talking with a girl called Lyuba from the bookbinding shop. She retorted sharply to something they had said. The boys leapt up, grabbed her legs, and lifted them in the air. She was in a defenseless position. While she supported herself on the ground with her hands, her skirt fell over her head. The boys held her that way and caressed her with their free hands. And then they let her down, and not roughly either. Did she slap them? Did she run away from them? Not at all. She sat down just as before and continued the argument. These were 16-year-old kids, and it was an adult camp with mixed categories. It was the same one that had the women's barracks for 500 where all the copulation took place without curtains, and which the kids used to enter importantly like men. In the children's colonies, the kids worked for 4 hours and then were supposed to be in school for 4. But all that schooling was a fake. When transferred to an adult camp, they had a 10-hour working day, except that their work norms were reduced, while their ration norms were the same as adults. They were transferred at the age of 16, but their undernourishment and improper development in camp and before camp endowed them at that age with the appearance of small, frail children. Their height was stunted, as were their minds and their interests. They were sometimes maintained in separate brigades, depending on the kind of work they were doing, and sometimes they were mixed into a general brigade with elderly invalids. Here, too, reduced physical labour was required of them, or simply native child labour. After the children's colony, their situation changed drastically. No longer did they get the children's ration which so tempted the jailers, and therefore the latter ceased to be their principal enemy. Some old men appeared in their lives on whom they could try their strength. Women appeared on whom they could try their maturity. Some real-life thieves appeared, fat-faced camp stormtroopers, who willingly undertook their guidance both in world outlook and in training in thievery. To learn from them was tempting, and not to learn from them was impossible. For a free reader, does the word thief perhaps sound like a reproach? In that case, he has understood nothing. This word is pronounced in the underworld in the same way that the word knight was pronounced among the nobility, and with even greater esteem, and not loudly but softly, like a sacred word. To become a worthy thief some day was the kid's dream. This was the elemental motivating force of their companionship. Yes, for even the most independent among them, for a young man pondering life, there was no destiny more reliable. On one occasion, at the Ivanovo Transit Prison, I spent the night in a cell for kids. In the next bunk to me was a thin boy, just over 15, called Slava, I think. It appeared to me that he was going through the whole kid ritual, somehow unwillingly, as if he were growing out of it or was weary of it. I thought to myself, this boy has not perished, and is more intelligent, and he will soon move away from the others. And we had a chat. The boy came from Kiev. One of his parents had died, and the other had abandoned him. Before the war, at the age of 9, Slava began to steal. He also stole when our army came, and after the war, and with a sad, thoughtful smile which was so old for 15, he explained to me that in the future, too, he intended to live only by thievery. You know, he explained to me very reasonably, that as a worker you can earn only bread and water, and my childhood was bad, so I want to live well. What did you do during the German occupation? I asked, trying to fill in the 2 years he had bypassed without describing them, the 2 years of the occupation of Kiev. He shook his head. Under the Germans I worked. What do you think, that I could have gone on stealing under the Germans? They shot you on the spot for that. And in adult camps, too, the kids retained, as the principal characteristic of their conduct, their concerted action in attack and their concerted action in resistance. This made them strong and freed them from restrictions. In their consciousness, there was no demarcation line between what was permissible and what was not permissible, and no concept whatever of good and evil. For them, everything that they desired was good, and everything that hindered them was bad. They acquired their brazen and insolent manner of behavior because it was the most advantageous form of conduct in the camp. And dissimulation and cunning served them very well in situations where strength could not carry the day. A kid could play the role of a boy saint. He could move you to tears, and all the while his comrades ransacked your bag behind your back. That rancorous company of theirs could wreak its vengeance on anyone at all, and just so as not to get mixed up with that horde, no one would come to the aid of their victim. When their purpose had been attained and their enemies divided, the kids would then hurl themselves in a pack on the single victim. And they were invincible. So many of them would attack at once that you couldn't even single them out, distinguish them, remember them. And you simply did not have enough hands and feet to beat them off. Here, as recounted by A. Y. Susi, are several pictures from Krivoshchekovo, penalty camp number 2 of Novosiblag. Life was lived in enormous half-dark dugouts for 500 each, which had been dug into the earth to a depth of 5 feet. The chiefs did not interfere with the life inside the compound, no slogans and no lectures. The thieves and kids held sway. Almost no one was taken out to work. Rations were correspondingly meagre. On the other hand, there was a surplus of time. One day they were bringing a bread box from the bread-cutting room under the guard of brigade members. The kids started a fake fight in front of the box itself, started shoving one another, and tipped the box over. The brigade members hurled themselves on the bread ration to pick it up from the ground. Out of 20 rations, they managed to save only 14. The fighting kids were nowhere to be seen. The mess hall at this camp was a plank lean-to, not adequate for the Siberian winter. The gruel and the bread ration had to be carried about 150 yards in the cold from the kitchen to the dugout. For the elderly invalids, this was a dangerous and difficult operation. They pushed their bread ration far down inside their shirt and gripped their mess tin with freezing hands. But suddenly, with diabolical speed, two or three kids would attack from the side. They knocked one old man to the ground, six hands frisked him all over, and they made off like a whirlwind. His bread ration had been pilfered, his gruel spilled, his empty mess tin lay there on the ground, and the old man struggled to get to his knees. And other Zeks saw this, and hastily bypassed the dangerous spot, hurrying to carry their own bread rations to the dugout. And the weaker their victim, the more merciless were the kids. They openly tore the bread ration from the hands of a very weak old man. The old man wept and implored them to give it back to him. "I am dying of starvation." "So you're going to kick the bucket soon anyway. What's the difference?" And the kids once decided to attack the invalids in the cold, empty building in front of the kitchen, where there was always a mob of people. The gang would hurl their victim to the ground, sit on his hands, his legs, and his head, search his pockets, take his makorka and his money, and then disappear. The big, strong Latvian Martinson was careless enough to appear in the compound, wearing the high brown leather boots of an English aviator, which were laced over hooks up to knee height. He wouldn't even take them off at night, and was confident of his strength. But they ambushed him when he lay down for a brief nap on the rostrum in the mess hall. The gang swooped swiftly to the assault, and fled just as swiftly, and he was without his boots. All the laces had been cut, and the boots jerked off. Look for them? But where? The boots would have been sent outside the compound immediately, through one of the jailers, and there sold for a high price. And what didn't the kids float out of the compound to be sold? Each time the camp chiefs, taking pity on their youth, issued them even slightly better footgear or duds, or some flattened-out pads for mattresses that had been taken away from the 58s. In several days it would all have been traded to the free employees for makorka, and the kids would once more be going around in tatters and sleeping on bare boards. It was enough for a careless free worker to go into the camp compound with a dog and turn his head for 1 second, and he could buy his dog's pelt that very same evening outside the camp compound. The dog would have been coaxed away, knifed, skinned, and cooked, all in a trice. There is nothing finer than thievery and brigandage. They provide nourishment. They're jolly. But young bodies also need simple exercise, innocent enjoyment, and relaxation. If they were given hammers to nail shell boxes together, they would brandish them about incessantly, and with huge enjoyment, even the girls, hammer nails into anything that came to hand, tables, walls, tree stumps. They used to be constantly fighting with each other, not just to knock over a bread box, but really fighting. They would pursue each other over bunks and in the aisles, and it didn't matter that they were stepping on legs, on belongings, spilling things, soiling things, waking people up, hurting others. They were playing. All children play like that, but for all ordinary children there are nonetheless parents. In our epoch, unfortunately, no more than nonetheless. And there is some controlling force over them, and they can be stopped, they can be reached, punished, sent away. But in camp all that was impossible. To get through to the kids with words was simply impossible. Human speech was not for them, their ears simply didn't admit anything that they themselves didn't need. If irritated old men started to grab them and pull them up short, the kids would hurl heavy objects at them. The kids found amusement in just about anything. They would grab the field shirt off an elderly invalid and play keep away, forcing him to run back and forth just as if he were their own age. Does he become angry and leave? Then he will never see it again. They will have sold it outside the compound for a smoke. And they will even come up to him afterward innocently. "Papasha, give us a light. Oh, come on now, don't be angry. Why did you leave? Why didn't you stay and catch it?" For adults, fathers and grandfathers, these boisterous games of the kids in the crowded conditions of camp could cause more anguish and be more hurtful than their robbing and their rapacious greed. It proved to be one of the most sensitive forms of humiliation, for an elderly person to be made equal with a young whippersnapper, if only it were equal, but not to be turned over to the tyranny of the whippersnappers. The kid's actions were unpremeditated, and they didn't mean to cause hurt or offence. They weren't pretending, they simply did not consider anyone a human being except themselves and the older thieves. That is how they came to perceive the world, and now they clung to that view. At the end of work, they would break into a column of adult zecs who were utterly fagged out, hardly able to stand, sunk in a kind of trance or reverie. The kids would jostle the column, not because they had to be first, this meant nothing, but just for the fun of it. They used to talk noisily, constantly taking the name of Pushkin in vain. Pushkin took it. Pushkin ate it. They used to direct obscene curses at God, Christ, and the Holy Virgin, and they would shout out all sorts of obscenity about sexual deviations and perversions, not even shamed by the presence of elderly women standing there, let alone the younger ones. During their short camp stay, they attained the peak, the summit, of freedom from society. During the periods of long roll calls in the camp compound, the kids used to chase each other around, torpedoing the crowd, knocking people into one another. "Well, peasant, why were you in the way?" Or they would run around a person, one after the other, as they might around a tree. And a person was even more useful than a tree, because you could shield yourself with him, jerk him, make him totter, tug him in different directions. This would have been hurtful, even when you were feeling cheerful. But when your whole life was broken, when a man had been cast into the distant pit of a camp to die, when death from hunger already hung over you and your vision was darkening, it was impossible to rise above yourself and have sympathy for the youngsters and the fact that they could play such carefree games in so dismal a place. No, the tormented elderly people were possessed with rage, and they used to shout at them, "Plague on you, little skunks! Scum! Mad dogs! Drop dead! I could strangle them with my own hands! Worse rats than the fascists! They've sent them to kill us!" And there was so much hatred in those shouts of the elderly invalids that if words could kill, they would have. Yes, and it really seemed that the kids had been set on them intentionally, because after prolonged thought, the camp chiefs could never have invented a more cruel whip. And just as in a successful chess game, all the combinations suddenly begin to mesh of themselves, and it seems as if they had been brilliantly thought out beforehand, so, too, a great deal succeeded in our system to the end of wearing people down more effectively. And it seems that the little devil imps of Christian mythology must have been just the same as these, and in no wise different. All the more so since their chief amusement, their constant symbol, their sign of greeting, and their threat was the slingshot. The index and middle fingers of the hand parted in a V sign, like agile, butting horns. But they were not for butting, they were for gouging, because they were aimed always at the eyes. This had been borrowed from the adult thieves, and indicated a seriously meant threat. "I'll gouge out your eyes, you shit!" And among the kids, too, this was a favorite game. All of a sudden, like a snake's head, a slingshot rises out of nowhere in front of an old man's eyes, and the fingers move steadily toward the eyes. They are going to put them out. The old man recoils. He is pushed in the chest just a bit, and another kid has already knelt on the ground right behind his legs, and the old man falls backward, his head banging the ground, accompanied by the gay laughter of the kids. And no one will ever help him up. And the kids don't even realize that they have done anything bad. It was merely fun. And you'd not catch those devils either. No way. And the old man, rising with difficulty, would whisper with rage, "If only I had a machine gun, I'd shoot them without pity." Old man T nourished a burning hatred for them. He used to say, "Nothing good can come of them anyway. For human beings, they're a plague. We have to annihilate them on the sly." And he worked out a means to this end. Whenever he succeeded in creeping up on a kid on the sly, he would hurl him to the ground and press down on the boy's chest with his knees until he could hear the ribs crack. But he didn't break them. He would let the kid up at that point.
T used to say that the kid wouldn't survive and that there wasn't a physician who could diagnose what was wrong with him. And by this means, T sent several kids to the next world before they themselves beat him to death. Hate begets hate. The black water of hate flows easily and quickly along the horizontal. That was easier than for it to erupt upward through a crater against those who condemned both the old and the young to a slave's fate. That is how small, stubborn fascists were trained by the joint action of Stalinist legislation, a gulag education, and the leaven of the thieves. It was impossible to invent a better method of brutalizing children. It was quite impossible to find a quicker, stronger way of implanting all the vices of camp in tiny, immature hearts. Even when it would have cost nothing to soften the heart of a child, the camp bosses didn't permit it. This was not the goal of their training. At Krivosh Chekovo Camp No. 1, a boy asked to be transferred so that he could be with his father in Camp No. 2. This was not permitted. After all, the rules required families to be broken up. And the boy had to hide in a barrel to get from one camp to the other and live there with his father in secret. And in their confusion, they assumed he had escaped and used a stick with spikes made of nails to poke about in the latrine pits to see whether or not he had drowned there. But it is only the beginning that is hard, for Volodya Snegiryov, at 15, was somehow strange to be imprisoned. But later, in the course of 6 terms, he managed to collect nearly a century, including 2 terms of 25 years each. He spent hundreds of days in punishment blocks and prisons. There, his young lungs acquired TB. For 7 years, he was on the all-union wanted list. After this, he was well set, of course, on the true thieves' path. Today, he is a Group 2 invalid, without one lung and 5 ribs. Vitya Kopchayev has been imprisoned continually since the age of 12. He has been sentenced 14 times, 9 of them for escaping. I have never yet lived in freedom legitimately. Yura Yermolov got work after his release but was fired because it was more important to give the job to a demobilized soldier. And he was forced to go on tour, with the end result a new prison term. Stalin's immortal laws on kids existed for 20 years, until the decree of April 24, 1954, which relaxed them slightly, releasing those kids who had served more than 1/3 of their first term. And what if it were 14? 20 years, 20 harvests, and 20 different age groups had been maimed with crime and depravity. So who dares cast a shadow on the memory of our great Corypheus? There were nimble children who managed to catch Article 58 very early in life. For example, Geli Pavlov got it at 12. From 1943 to 1949, he was imprisoned in the colony in Zakopsk. For Article 58, in fact, no minimum age existed. That is what they said even in public lectures on jurisprudence. As, for example, in Tallinn in 1945. Dr. Usman knew a 6-year-old boy imprisoned in a colony under 58. But that evidently is the record. Sometimes the arrest of the child was put off for the sake of appearances, but took place later anyway. For example, Vera Inchik, the daughter of a charwoman, and 2 other girls, all aged 14, discovered, Yeisk, in 1932, that in the course of the liquidation of the kulaks, little children were being thrown out to die. The girls, like the revolutionaries earlier, decided to protest. They wrote out their protests in their own handwriting on sheets of paper taken from their school notebooks and posted them in the marketplace themselves, expecting immediate and universal indignation. A doctor's daughter, it would appear, was arrested immediately. But the daughter of the charwoman was only noted on a list. When 1937 came, she too was arrested for spying on behalf of Poland. And where, if not in this chapter, are we going to mention the children orphaned by the arrest of their parents? The children of the women of the religious commune near Kosta were fortunate. When their mothers were sent off to Solovki in 1929, the children were soft-heartedly left in their own homes and on their own farms. The children looked after the orchards and vegetable gardens themselves, milked their goats, assiduously studied at school, and sent their school grades to their parents on Solovki, together with assurances that they were prepared to suffer for God as their mothers had. And, of course, the party soon gave them this opportunity. Considering the instructions to disunite exiled children and their parents, how many of these kids must there have been even back in the 20s? Remember that 48%. And who will ever tell us of their fate? Here is Galia Benediktova. Her father was a Petrograd typesetter, an anarchist, and her mother was a seamstress from Poland. Galia remembers very well her sixth birthday in 1933. They celebrated it joyfully. The next morning, she woke up, her father and mother were gone, and some stranger in uniform was messing about among their books. True, a month later, her mother returned to her. The women and children were to travel to Tobolsk on their own, as free people. Only the men went on a prisoner transport. They lived there as a family, but they had not managed to complete the 3-year term before her mother was arrested again, and her father was shot. Her mother died in prison a month later, and Galia was taken to an orphanage in a monastery near Tobolsk. Conditions there were such that the young girls lived in constant fear of violence. Then she was transferred to an orphanage in the city. The director talked to her like this: "You are the children of enemies of the people, and nonetheless you are being clothed and fed." No. How humane this dictatorship of the proletariat is. Galia became like a wolf cub. At the age of 11, she was already given her first political interrogation. Subsequently, she got a 10-ruble bill, although she did not serve it out in full. At the age of 40, she lives a lonely life in the Arctic and writes, "My life came to an end with my father's arrest. I love him so much to this very day that I am afraid even to think about it. That was a whole different world, and my heart is sick with love for him." And Svetlana Sedova also remembers, "I can never forget the day they took all our things out into the street and sat me there on top of them, and a heavy rain was falling. From the age of 6 I have been the daughter of a traitor to the motherland, and there can be nothing more awful in life than this." They were taken into NKVD foster homes, into special homes. The majority had their surnames changed, particularly those who had famous names. Yura Bukharin learned his real name only in 1956, but the Chebotaryov name was not, it seems, particularly famous. The children grew up totally purged of their parents' disgrace. Rosa Kovacs, a native of Philadelphia, brought here as a small child by her communist father, after leaving an NKVD foster home, found herself during the war in the American zone of Germany. What fates befall people? And what happened? She returned to the Soviet motherland and got her 25 years. Even a superficial glance reveals one characteristic. The children, too, were destined for imprisonment. They, too, in their turn, would be sent off to the promised land of the archipelago, sometimes even at the same time as their parents. Take the 8th grader Nina Perigud. In November 1941, they came to arrest her father. There was a search. Suddenly, Nina remembered that inside the stove lay a crumpled, but not yet burned, humorous rhyme, and it might have just stayed there, but out of nervousness, Nina decided to tear it up at once. She reached into the firebox, and the dozing policeman grabbed her. And this horrible sacrilege, in a schoolgirl's handwriting, was revealed to the eyes of the Czechists. "The stars in heaven are shining down, and their light falls on the dew. Smolensk is already lost and gone, and we're going to lose Moscow too." And she expressed the desire, "We only wish they'd bomb the school, we're awfully tired of studies." Naturally, these full-grown men engaged in saving their motherland deep in the rear in Tambov, these knights with hot hearts and clean hands, had to scotch such a mortal danger. Won't we ever, some day, won't we ever
haul out at least one such mole who authorized the arrest of an eighth grader because of a rhyme, to see what his forehead is like, and his ears.
Nina was arrested. Confiscated for her interrogation were her diaries from the sixth grade and a counter-revolutionary photograph, a snapshot of the destroyed Vavarinskaya church. "What did your father talk about?" cried the knights with the hot hearts. Nina only sobbed. They sentenced her to 5 years of imprisonment and 3 years deprivation of civil rights, even though she couldn't lose them since she didn't yet have them. In camp, of course, she was separated from her father. The branch of a white lilac tree tormented her. Her girlfriends were taking their examinations. Nina suffered the way a real criminal was supposed to suffer when being reformed. What did my classmate Zoya Kosmodemyanskaya do? And how foul a thing am I? The security officers pushed down hard on that pedal. But you can still catch up with her. Just help us. Oh, you corrupters of young souls, how prosperously you are living out your lives. You are never going to have to stand up somewhere blushing and tongue-tied and confess what slops you poured over souls. But Zoya Leshcheva managed to outdo her whole family, and here is how. Her father, her mother, her grandfather, her grandmother, and her elder adolescent brothers had all been scattered to distant camps because of their faith in God. But Zoya was a mere 10 years old. They took her to an orphanage in Ivanovo province, and there she declared she would never remove the cross from around her neck, the cross which her mother had hung there when she said farewell. And she tied the knot of the cord tighter, so they would not be able to remove it when she was asleep. The struggle went on and on for a long time. Zoya became enraged. "You can strangle me and then take it off a corpse." Then she was sent to an orphanage for retarded children, because she would not submit to their training. And in that orphanage were the dregs, a category of kids worse than anything described in this chapter. The struggle for the cross went on and on. Zoya stood her ground. Even here she refused to learn to steal or to curse. "A mother as sacred as mine must never have a daughter who is a criminal. I would rather be a political, like my whole family." And she became a political, and the more her instructors and the radio praised Stalin, the more clearly she saw in him the culprit responsible for all their misfortunes. And refusing to give in to the criminals, she now began to win them over to her views. In the courtyard stood one of those mass-produced plaster statues of Stalin, and mocking and indecent graffiti began to appear on it. Kids love sport. The important thing is to point them in the right direction. The administration kept repainting the statue, kept watch over it, and reported the situation to the MGB. And the graffiti kept on appearing, and the kids kept on laughing. Finally, one morning, they found that the statue's head had been knocked off and turned upside down, and inside it were feces. This was a terrorist act. The MGB came, and began, in accordance with all their rules, their interrogations and threats. "Turn over the gang of terrorists to us, otherwise we are going to shoot the lot of you for terrorism." And there would have been nothing remarkable if they had. So what? 150 children shot? If he himself had known about it, he would himself have given the order. It's not known whether the kids would have stood up to them or given in, but Zoya Leshcheva declared, "I did it all myself. What else is the head of that papa good for?" And she was tried, and she was sentenced to the supreme measure, no joke. But because of the intolerable humanitarianism of the 1950 law on the restoration of capital punishment, the execution of a 14-year-old was forbidden. And therefore they gave her a tenner. It's surprising it wasn't 25. Up to the age of 18, she was in ordinary camps, and from the age of 18 on, she was in special camps. For her directness and her language, she got a second camp sentence, and, it seems, a third one as well. This book is continued on Cassette 6, Side 1.